With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, Dane Baptiste Questions Everything listeners. The Hizzer, Howard here. Just saying that Dane is in Australia on tour, which I imagine is very nice and sunny, but it makes it a little bit complicated to arrange, you know, recording the show. So what we thought we'd do is that Dane would talk to interesting people that he's on tour with, some comedians, and who else knows, you know, he might bump into other people. So yeah, Dane's flying solo. It's a great listen. I pop a question in there anyway, but enjoy the show, guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this special episode of Dane Baptiste Questions Everything. Your host, comedian, writer, and occasional actor Dane Baptiste is currently on tour in Western Australia, but that won't stop me from posing the questions that need to be asked. And we are talking everything from my usual producer friend and co-host Howard Cohen, aka The Hizzer, who isn't currently with me. His question: I've never been to Australia. Is it still good as it looks in pictures, or have the humans ruined it? A good question, Howard. I would say that given that Australia is known for everything, including the flora and fauna being able to kill you, the humans haven't ruined it too much. But I've not been doing it for that long as a tour, but I'm sure we'll find out. But for the most part, humans seem to be doing a pretty good job. But I guess we'll find out. But if you do like the show, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts, or follow us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from, and you'll never miss an episode where you can hear all of our very special questions being asked and answered by our very special guests. With that being said, on today's show is an Australian comedian who I'm currently spending a lot of time with. So they are very patient, first of all. They have taken the comedy world by storm by winning the Royal Comedy Award at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival in 2021. And they have a very successful newsletter of anecdotes that you can sign up to for more hilarity called I Shave My Legs for This. And they are currently smashing it on this tour of Western Australia. Please welcome to the show, Ms. Plu. Do it again. Please welcome to the show, Miss Prue Blake.
Thanks for having me, Dane. It's a name that actually trips up a lot of MCs.
It was going so well up until that point.
They get overconfident with it.
Yeah, I was on a roll, yeah. And I thought, yeah, it's going great.
Think, how's Prue Blake going to trip me up? I can say this in my sleep. But there's something about the not many letters, but enough to get you into trouble.
I know, but I thought especially worse because I also have a monosyllabic name, which people mess up all the time, and I really thought that I'd be able to do a much better job. But yeah, almost called you Pure in that instance.
I like Pure. I feel like the antithesis of my personality.
it's like a nice antithesis. So we like to first of all ask the question: do you think humans have ruined Australia?
Do I think humans have ruined Australia? Well, I mean, this is also my first time touring through regional Western Australia, so we're both seeing it through fresh eyes.
First time in an outback.
And I feel like Australia has maybe benefited where other countries struggle, in that there's just so much of it.
There's a lot of space here.
There's a lot of space. Like, we've only been able to get our hands on a pretty small percentage.
Yeah.
And there's still a lot of wildlife.
Yeah, so there's more nature than there are people for the time being.
Yeah, for the time being, until sea levels rise.
We're waiting on that. Well, as far as I've seen, you're not like the UK. We have sewage in our water system.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we left the EU, and they used to be like, you shouldn't pour, like, piss and shit into, like, your waterways. And we were like, we don't want to do that. And so that's
actually
where we
are
now.
Actually, that rule is a dumb European rule.
Yeah, they were like, that's way too European. Yeah. Maybe for the French.
Maybe. La-di-da.
Yeah, they're too, they don't want to swim in floaters, but not in the UK where we've got true grit.
We do have some beaches that are a bit like that.
I haven't seen them yet. We have seasides in the UK. Okay. So as bad as you think your beaches are, trust me, I've seen much, much worse. But with the nature of this podcast, and also because I know that somewhere in the UK, my producer friend is like doing this thing where he wants me to move along.
Good, he's really got in your head.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the impression that I thought he would ever leave, but that's where we are now. And I'm sure he'd be very happy about that fact. So thank you very much, Howard Cohen, aka The Hizzer. You have imprinted on my brain permanently, which is great. But yeah, essentially, what Howard would say if he was here is that after making a joke about humans ruining stuff and swimming amongst shit, he would say it's probably time for a question as this format dictates. So as our very esteemed guest, Prue, I'd like to invite you to ask the first question, which could be any question you'd like, which I'd like to discuss for about 25 minutes to about half an hour.
Okay.
And then I would like to pose a question to you as well to discuss for the same amount of time. And then I would love for you to tell our listeners and viewers where they can find out about your great works, past, present and future.
Sound right, good? I love an agenda, for the session.
Absolutely. So, with that kind of hopefully maintaining some structure, the floor is yours to ask the first question.
Okay, well, this is my question, and I think it builds on the question Howard asked quite nicely.
You getting included, Howard, you lucky man, doing fuck all.
Gutted you're not here.
if you knew him
forever.
Right, exactly, but if you knew him, you'd understand why we're missing him so much. There you go, Howard.
really good shout out. But the question I wanted to ask is whether you think in 2023, mm-hmm. neither of us have kids,
mm-hmm.
do you think you need to be an optimist to be willing to be a parent?
That is a good question. Howard would also want me to ask, because he likes to follow up, what has prompted this question?
Yeah, it's just something I've been thinking about.
Oh, cool. Yeah. We were having this discussion very briefly after we went for a lovely dinner.
We had a brilliant pasta dinner.
Brilliant pasta dinner. And I think it's a very relevant question, because I am also at a stage now where, I guess, historically in this line of work, you know, you tend to find that we have very little time for what I would perceive as the more conventional paths that most people in this part of the world go through. I guess as I've gotten older, I've done comedy for 10 years now, and running out of excuses. And yeah, maybe the last remaining one would be an existential one, where it's kind of like, given the way, you know,
the state of the world.
The state of the world, especially from the perspective of people that observe things for a living.
Yeah.
Would you want to bring kids into this world? I think it's a good question. I think for me, I guess I've tried to have the attitude where I don't believe like having kids is an entitlement, and I'm aware that there are a number of people in this world for a number of different reasons who are unable to conceive, even though they want kids. So I always try to have that perspective where even though I can, doesn't mean I necessarily should or will.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that, what I try to do is have perspective and consider the fact that I'm sure that in many relative ways, when my parents are thinking about giving birth to me or making me alongside my sister, they would have been dealing with the same kind of existential crises in terms of the state of the economic state of their environment, as well as the social climate.
And I guess they were right? We're the first...
Yeah.
You know, I'm a millennial.
Yeah, me too.
And we're the first generation that hasn't done as well as our parents.
Yeah, this is the thing, because that's the idea, is that my parents, when I was growing up the whole time, the thing they would always say to me is they'd always be like, I want to give you everything I never had, and we wanted just to make sure you do better than we did. And I think in many ways, there's been a number of different opportunities, like, for example, pursuing the job I have now, which I definitely wouldn't have been able to consider without a certain level of support from my parents, even though I would say that they weren't necessarily on board with it right away. I'm not sure what
was
your
experience. It's very hard to be on board with an open mic.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Explaining the logic behind being an open mic comedian is just, yeah, it's a tough one. It's like, you're going where for how much money?
Every night.
Every night. Yeah. And why do you do that? Because you like it.
Yeah.
And yeah, explaining to immigrant parents that I want a job that I love.
That's not what jobs are for.
That's not how jobs work at all. And I remember as well, because like one of the first things, the first job I ever had was I had a paper round, and I remember being like saying to my dad like, oh, it's not great, and not really enjoying it. And I'm sure that there are many dads out there who would have said something positively reinforcing. My dad's always been quite a stoic realist, and he was kind of like, well, the work don't stop there, son. All he said was kind of like, you know, it's not going to get any easier where work is concerned. And I feel like my dad's working life was a large inspiration for me actually finally pursuing comedy in earnest, because he got quite ill when I was working about 10 or so years ago. He had a collapsed lung, he got pneumonia. And I remember that he was still trying to go into work the week before he got really bad. He was still trying to go into work. And he also had just gotten a award for perfect attendance.
Ooh.
Yeah, you'd think so. All would be, you think, for someone who's never missed a day of work, which he had never done. And they gave him a clock. And I was kind of like, he understands how punctuality works, clearly.
Was he always attending but 25 minutes late?
That's what I mean, yeah. Which I don't think he described as perfect attendance. But yeah, they were just like, yeah, here's a clock. But and he used to work for Ford.
Okay.
So you think that would be something more automotively related?
Yeah.
Like, you know, a car would be great. I mean, a car would be great. And that's what you'd think if someone was, you know, dedicated and be working in the same place for 20 plus years. A car would probably be great.
And surely you've got some kicking around.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. You know, you've got some cars left over, or at least maybe a upgrade to the car you currently have. Something that would probably be of more benefit than a clock. Also, if they got him a car, there's a clock already in it.
Exactly.
So that would have best of both worlds. So that would have separated. Yeah, exactly. And that would have definitely, I think, would have covered all of their bases. But they went for a clock. But I remember seeing that, and you know, someone who definitely has a much more traditional attitude towards employment. My dad, worked very tirelessly, and receiving that, and also, you know, having to depend upon at the time. You know, and I'm definitely a proponent and supporter of the NHS, but I understand that even back then, 10 years ago, they were definitely overworked, and they were almost missed his diagnosis of his pneumonia. And I looked at all of that and I thought, you know, given that somebody who works as honestly and tirelessly as that can be in this position without much support, that's enough for me to be like, well, you know what, fuck it. Because, you know, our biggest fear about pursuing our, I suppose, creative potential would be, how do I feed myself? How do I pay my rent? And how do I take care of myself as a human being? And I saw very clearly you can do all of that and shit can still go left.
Stuff. So yeah, you always hear those stories about people that work tirelessly and loyally for a company their whole lives and died of a heart attack the year before they were meant to retire and suddenly live.
Yeah, exactly. Know? And you just wonder if it's really worth it. But I think in order to ponder whether it's a world worth bringing kids into, I guess you have to consider what we're dealing with at the moment. So I'd say, you know, climatologically would be one of the first worries I would have where, like, I'm like, you know, people do tend to think initially about being able to provide for their children financially.
Yeah.
But I feel like it doesn't really matter how much money you give your kids. If the air is not safe to breathe, the water's not safe to drink, we don't really have access to resources, or if even if it doesn't affect you directly, it will affect you indirectly, because obviously we have to live in a society and that can have an effect on you too. Because I just think, even if nothing else, psychologically, like, as you said yourself, it's a lot for somebody to deal with.
And that feeling of you want to keep your kids safe and you want to be protected,
somewhat sheltered.
Yeah.
And I think it's, especially in the advent of social media, it's much harder to shield your kids from the world and oversee that kind of thing. And I think there's a lot more obstacles.
I think on the flip side,
mm-hmm.
if climate change gets really bad and we enter kind of a era of climate wars, having a well-timed child might garner a little bit of sympathy, help you get a little bit more resources, a little more protection.
It could be
the way to forward.
It could be the case, And
they'd have to be cute.
Oh, they have to be very cute. But then I'm worried about, like, in the world we live in now, does that make them like a, you know, potentially a donor? In the dystopian world where someone's like, this kid is amazing, I bet they taste good. Like, I know that's going real far. who knows how far it will go, especially for the fate of, like, cute children, like I'd hope to have one day. But I think...
You definitely have cute kids.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think I have some cute kids. I think... I don't want to put too much pressure on them, but I hope they'd be funny children.
Really?
Yeah, but then I think at the same time, like, your kids normally tend to act rebelliously towards you, so they'll be like, this guy and his dad jokes, and it's like, I'll have you know that I actually am a jokester that became a dad.
Yeah.
I was doing this before you came along, so these are not dad jokes. This is just a comedian doing jokes who now is incidentally a dad, and I don't need to do it for your validation, children. Thank you very much.
I think that's funny. I want my kids to be very serious.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think that's quite funny, like a serious little kid.
Yeah, and just be like, you need to behave and grow up.
And like fact-checking you all the time.
Oh, yeah, I like a fact-checking kid. Yeah. But yeah, I think as long as they're like alert, I suppose, and aware to the world, that is the main thing. Because I suppose there are certain aspects of a person's personality that you're not necessarily in control of. So I suppose for me, it's the idea that most kids, you'd want everyone to be able to adapt. And so, you know, there are a number of aspects of the world now that I've probably spoken to my parents about in a very frustrated way, but not necessarily try to blame them or be like, why am I even here? Because obviously, who can predict what happens? Like, I went to university, for example, at a time where it was a practice that was becoming celebrated very much in the UK, and we had like a left-wing government in, and they were doing student loans and stuff, and so got to go to university. So for my parents, that's something they wouldn't even have considered. So they were like, university, and at first I was like, I'm not sure, and they were like, I think you know, you better be fucking sure.
I didn't know that not going to university was an option.
Yeah, exactly.
Until my little brother didn't go. I was like, you can get away with that?
Yeah, there you go. But see, unfortunately, it's the first, you're the oldest.
Yeah, I'm the oldest.
Litmus test child.
Yeah.
That's always the problem.
I've got all the attention.
Yeah, all the experimentation.
All the experimentation, yeah.
All the methods, all the trial and error. I've heard this first account from my older sister as well.
Yeah.
That she's always kind of like, you know, your parents are just trying to work out what they were doing with me.
Oh, they're so relaxed. My mother, yeah. I don't care.
My sister's like, not only are they relaxed, sometimes they're like, you do some parenting as well. Like, you know, you are a direct product of our academy, so you can take care of these kids.
Oh,
so.
No, my parents didn't do that.
Yeah, my sister definitely has, as a result of her being tasked with some free babysitting, she's definitely more of a, I'd say more of a young aunt than an older sister.
What's the age difference?
2 years. It's 2 years, but to hear her tell it and act it is definitely 10 to 15.
I'm 5 years older than my little brother, and I remember my mum would make me drive him to school when I was in uni, so he was in high school, and I'd be so hungover, I'd have to pull over and like vomit out of the car.
This is between you and I, young man. This could all be
like, don't tell mom.
Yeah, exactly.
I got up, didn't I?
Yeah, I'm doing you a favor as well.
Yeah.
And I feel like your sibling driving you to school is probably less embarrassing than a parent driving you to school.
Until they puke in front of all your friends.
Yeah. But then you could just be like, yeah, my sister.
You'll understand. In 5 years, you'll understand.
Yeah, you'll understand exactly where this is. You guys, I'm just showing you your future. Yeah. So, which is good. And maybe that's the key, is that you have to be very realistic with your kids about what to expect. And I think that probably helps, is that maybe realism is the way to go as opposed to optimism, and giving kids an idea of what's going to happen in the world. Like, I remember Chris Rock has a bit where he says, I tell my daughters all the time, when you go out there, nobody gives a fuck about you.
Yeah.
Everyone who cares about you is in here, which I'm not sure is necessarily the best way to go. I think that could make someone quite neurotic, but I definitely want to be realistic with my kids and, you know, teach them about aspects of, you know, life. Inequality in life. I guess all life challenges, like inequality, and, you know, that capitalism might be somewhat of a festering tumor on a human civilization. But
it is. Yeah, it's funny. I really remember being like a young kid and calling my dad into my bedroom and saying, Dad, I'm so scared that I'm going to die. And he would just say, you will. We all die. He was going, that's a certainty, that's going to happen. And I would have been maybe like 7 or 8 years
First time you heard the word certainty, and you're like, this is the context you're going to use it in.
Yeah, he's telling a 7 or 8 year old kid, you know, the only thing certain in life is death and taxes.
I think my dad said the same as well. Death and taxes. I mean, I didn't even have social security there, but national insurance then. What are you taxing?
My
life, apparently.
Okay, try and explain tax to me now. That's harder than death.
What effect did that have on you?
I think it was nice to know an adult would tell you the truth, but I was still very nervous about life for a long time.
I think
you want parents to kind of say everything will be all right.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't feel like I could say that to kids if I had them.
No.
And I think the reason I asked about it in terms of optimism is that when I was younger, I always grew up wanting kids, and like, I love hanging out with kids, love spending time with children.
Yeah.
And then as I've gotten older, I'm 30, now.
Mm-hmm.
And when I pictured my life at 30,
yeah,
when I was in the beginning of my 20s, you'd think, oh, I'll definitely have a house, I'll have heaps of money, I'll probably be married.
Yeah, I'll be probably pushing it by 30, but, you know, I'll probably be 2 or 3 kids deep by then.
Yeah, yeah. You know? And now you're like, I have none of those things.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm probably another decade away from even getting close.
Yeah.
And then the biological clock is, you know, it hasn't really caught up to the way we live our lives now.
No, it's, it's still got a bit of evolution to do. Still analog.
So much of being a parent, or particularly a mother, is doing extra washing up, extra cleaning, extra cooking, and I hate doing all of those things just for myself.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't want to have to triple the load.
Yeah, or also have your worth as a person measured by these abilities to do this stuff, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'd be more interested in being a parent if I could be a dad.
Yeah. Well, the way the world's going, that is a possibility now as well. Yeah, because I'll be honest, my partner, she does a lot of these things that would be regarded as masculine.
Mm.
So like housework, whether it's like building furniture, or putting up shelves.
She does the IKEA flat pack.
Yeah, she does the flat pack. She'll determine, like, you know, arrangement of furniture and stuff like that as well. She's in charge of the feng shui.
My boyfriend does all the vacuuming.
Mm-hmm.
All the dishes.
I love the vacuuming. That's me, yeah. Vacuuming, loading the dishwasher, washing dishes. That's where I, like, literally, if we have a barbecue, she's on the grill.
Yeah, I'd be on the grill.
I'm on cocktails.
Yeah,
I'm on cocktails. I'm doing hosting. So
cocktails, you know, and a gab.
Yeah, exactly.
Put
so
yeah.
I'm just there. It's cocktails and tea. That's what I'm serving all around to everybody. And I'm happy in that role. So I think, you know, that I think that's an important thing as well about being able to approach the idea of raising the child with a certain level of optimism. I think that definitely comes from how your own self image and how you are, your own coping strategies.
Yeah.
And how you're able to kind of deal with conflict and adversity.
And building a new way to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
As well, that doesn't follow the traditional models that haven't been particularly fair.
Exactly. I mean, that's useful to me as well, because I suppose that, you know, people argue that you are a product of your upbringing, whether that is a traumatic or positive. But I think in most people's childhoods, there's going to be aspects of both. In my experience, and in terms of anecdotes I've been told by parents, because a lot of people who are my age now are now parents and have been parents for a long time, normally I'd be like, I'm not sure what the fuck I can give a kid. And they'd be like, well, they don't really need much when you're young, mainly just your presence. And then obviously I was also in the same position as you, like 30 years old. Like, the idea was to, you know, be married, be in the career by now, and in the career that is, like, prosperous one. And my goodness.
Not a dodgy one like comedy.
Yeah, not a dodgy one like comedy. Something that could pay my bills very comfortably. But yeah, at 30, I almost found myself living what would have been my, at the time, what I consider to be an existential nightmare. Childless, single, living with my parents, not knowing what I wanted to do next. And I think in many ways that having that experience could be much more effective in terms of being able to give a child a sense of optimism. Because I think most people worry about reaching a point in their lives where they may not have achieved their milestones or the goals they set for themselves. And for a lot of people, that can feel like some kind of failure. And I think that can affect people. I think people do a lot of things, whether it's being a job they might not necessarily enjoy or being in a relationship they don't necessarily enjoy, for the sake of having some kind of stability.
Mm.
And I think being able to have the experience of instability and be able to adapt and react to that has been very helpful, because I think when I did think about having kids, one of the most important parts of support I wanted to be able to give my kids was to be able to tell them, like, you can pursue your dreams or do what you want. And, you know, if it doesn't work out, at least you know. And what you're not left with is this kind of, like, voice in the back of your head being like, what if?
Yeah, so that's what awesome. I want my next stand-up show to be about. How I think chasing your dreams skips a generation.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, like, do you know Dimitri Martin?
Yeah.
I feel like I heard he was on a podcast talking about that whole thing where, you know, you normally find, like, skilled workers, or, like, I suppose what you'd call people that work in manufacturing or, like, in factory and stuff. Agriculture want their kids to be professionals and mainly have like a desk or office job.
Hmm.
And then professionals want their kids to be, I suppose, in, I guess, scholarly jobs like being legal or clerical or medical. And then those people in those professionals want their kids to be like scholars. scholars want their kids to be artists, and artists don't give a fuck what their kids do.
I was always so jealous of the kids whose parents were arty.
Yeah, definitely.
You're like, that's the dream.
Yeah, definitely. Let them be who they want and do what they want. I mean, even kids, because I went to school with a few kids who had parents that were athletes, and they were also being pushed into like things very early. And I was kind of like, I wish I had a parent. Do I wish I had like a showbiz parent like that? Or someone... But I think the idea was like a parent that's actively involved and you're trying to realise your potential. Because
you want like a William Sisters dad.
Yeah. Well, that's what I thought I wanted.
Yeah.
Because I think it can go one of two ways. I think if you're interested in doing something and your parents have an idea of how you can achieve that, then it's good to back you. But I suppose my parents weren't really on me like Richard Williams. But they were... I think my parents definitely... Because they used to say to me, like, if I'd be like, hey, I got an A on this test. And they'd be like, well, you're not doing it for me. You're doing it for you. And I'd be like, I'm not the one who grounds myself if I don't do well in school. Or I don't deny myself the opportunity.
My parents would be like, what happened to the plus?
That's definitely my mum. Yeah. They'd be like, you're doing it for you. And I'd be like, what do you mean I'm doing it for me?
Yeah.
If you were doing this for me, I'd be at ninja school right now. Training in my life's dream. Or being an animator of of good cartoons.
I'm more of a C's get degree kind of person.
Exactly. And I guess on reflection now, though, I'm like, I understand when I said that, because the idea was about developing your own self-start, in sense of being a self-starter and motivating yourself. Because if you did find yourself in a situation whereby you're 30 years old and you don't have any kids and you don't know what you want to do next, when you do work it out, you kind of are able to motivate yourself.
Yeah.
If you're not going to receive that from your parents. Because I'd say overall, and especially in the last couple of years of my career, like, I think my dad was always supportive. He just wasn't vocal. He'd be like, you can do it, son. I guess he was more like, along with you're working hard on what you're doing and not being bummy or like just half-assing it, then that's cool, and you'll work out what you're doing. And I think my mum's probably more supportive now. But that's because they're more aware of what you do now, because obviously you're a bit more visible.
As it gets
a bit bigger.
Rungs. I think that's been the big lesson for me for the last few years. And I guess the other side of parenting is I've had to kind of learn, like, nothing I do will ever get the level of approval from my parents that I want.
Yeah.
Like, they'll never be truly...
Exactly.
Happy enough for me to feel it.
Oh, no.
And
exactly.
I think it's a big lesson to be like, okay, I actually do need to just live life for me. And
yes, it's a,
not
it's
for
a big
my
lesson
parents.
To learn. Yeah.
And that's why I have to get a tattoo soon.
Oh, yeah.
Don't have any tattoos.
Oh, nice.
Because my parents hate them. And I think now that would be my, like, okay.
Yeah.
You're free.
And you know what? To wait 30 years to rebel visibly... Yeah. That's a sign of a very good kid.
Yeah, I'm a good kid.
Yes, it's a good
child.
Kid at heart. Yeah. Exactly. I totally get it. It's like, you know, my older sister, she barely drinks and stuff and does it on a very, very rare occasion. Whereas I'm just like, at Christmas, I'm glup, 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 glup. But I know, I think you make a very good point, Prue. Because I definitely think one of the traits I hope my child definitely develops is that kind of... self-belief, and also definitely somebody who realises that their life is their own.
They're independent.
And they're independent, yeah. Because I think, again, and it wasn't necessarily, you know, they're a malicious endeavour for my parents, but I think for a long time they kind of were like, I suppose they had enough influence that a lot of the stuff I did, like you said, I thought I was doing it to please my parents.
Yeah.
And I feel like when I started doing stuff independently and pursuing stuff that I wanted to do, then I was in a good space. And I think it's maybe, and I also think it allowed me to relate better to my parents, because by now doing myself and basically embracing the responsibility for my own life, it means I'm not going to be like, well, you guys should have done this when I was a kid and I need to be doing this. Because while that might be valid, you'll reach a point in your life where, you know, your parents just can't have the same influence in your life anymore. And like, I'm 40 now, in my 40s, and you know, I had a lot of beef with my parents when I was in my 20s.
Yeah.
But I've lived another 20 years since then, so it's kind of
now
like...
you get them more.
Yeah, I get them more, but also it's kind of like, how long can you blame them before, as a grown person, you can take responsibility? So if you do need to either distance yourself from negative reinforcement, or whether it's therapy, or being counselled, or just confronting your parents, then... you got to do it at some point. And so
that's funny, I have a joke in my set about how, you know, my whole teenage years, my 20s, my mom would be saying, I'm not your friend, I'm your mother.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it switches, and she's desperate to be my mate.
You're like...
And I'm like, I'm not ready.
Yeah, exactly. Take your time. Let me get to know you as a person first. I don't know what you're like on that level. So
you're still firmly in the mum category for
Exactly.
Yeah.
Maybe when I have a kid, you can be a friend.
Yeah.
But we'll see how it goes. No,
then
I
we can relate
that.
As peers.
Yeah. And then, yeah. As long as you're prepared to hear feedback.
Yeah.
That is so true. I mean, I just... I think I definitely have a better relationship with my parents. I haven't had the experience yet of having children where I can be like, oh, I see what you mean. I think, but you know what it is, I think there's a lot of things, like I said, when I see the state of the world now, I in many ways do have respect for my parents.
Mm.
Especially think with the racial climate in like the UK and the States, where my parents are residents and they spend a lot of time between both places. My parents never gave me what I call glass ceiling thinking.
Mm.
And it's not to say that they didn't deal with that themselves or their own kind of trauma, but I think it's very important for them not to kind of relay that to me. Because sometimes I used to be like, you never really talked that much about the racism or discrimination that you guys experienced.
Mm.
And I just think, is that because they aren't able to, or is it because they're in denial about it?
Or
is it
internalized?
Yeah, internalized, yeah. And is it something that they just don't want to talk about because it's seen as much more culturally affable to just deal with this shit like in a quiet and dignified manner, because I don't want them to necessarily do that. But in retrospect now, I understand why they did it, because I feel like my parents just wanted me to like not think that my race may necessarily hold me back.
Yeah.
And as you said, your parents always want you to be a echelon up.
Yeah.
Professionally. So they were kind of like, you're going to do this, nothing's going to be able to stop you. And
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
And, you know,
Mindy Kaling always talks about how she thinks that was why she was successful, because her parents instilled her with the confidence of a straight white man.
Yeah. I think my parents were exactly the same. And my mum especially was like, you'll also talk like one too.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think, my main thing for mum was like, my teenage years have been like, pull up your pants, pull up your pants. Why won't you pull up your pants?
Look smart.
Like, yeah, but I'm like, this is the style, baby.
Yeah.
This is the style.
But you were doing that real like pant undies sticking out for yards.
Yeah, I was a few yards. Yeah. Nothing crazy. Like you couldn't see my butt.
Pants under the bum.
But yeah, just in maybe around the bum equator. So maybe like the butt circumference. Then it was like some kind of compromise there at least.
Yeah.
That I wasn't going mental with it, because I'm actually like, that probably would have put her in an early grave. But naturally over time, the pants went up. You just get to that point, and I guess you know, you have to, and that's the thing as well. I think that pants based analogy is me saying that, you know, at some point I think if you give your kids the tools to work stuff out, I think over time they'll be able to adapt to a world that is currently going through a massive state of flux at the minute. So I definitely think you can't necessarily be always optimistic, and I think a sign of being a good parent is you're always going to worry about the welfare of your kids, and they're going to, and you might say to them, it's going to be fine. You, in your head, you might be like, oh my God. Like, even like with kids aren't mine, I sometimes see kids walking around and exploring, and they might be walking too close to something or too close to something. And like, I get quite uptight anyway. But I think, sometimes I think, well, if that parent doesn't mind that much, then...
Yeah, I can't even imagine that feeling. Like, sometimes my partner really loves going for walks late at night, and he's a 6'5" man.
Yeah.
And even then, I still feel so stressed.
Still by the window, like, the window.
I love you so much, I would hate for anything to happen to you.
Exactly, yeah. So I think that's a lot of where it stems from. And I feel like that is a big part of my neurosis about having kids, is like, I definitely am a parent that will drive my car through a school gate if I found out people were picking on my kids, and definitely could kidnap a teacher and put them in the back of a trunk of a car and be like, A plus, I think you'll find.
My kid's a genius.
Yeah, you'll see. Yeah. But no, I just think, yeah, the main thing is just to, it's such a good point. And I think for me, the key is that I have to just be honest about looking at the more positive and negative aspects of myself, and the negative aspects I need to work on, and the positive ones I could just continue to kind of reinforce and have those pass on to my kids. But I think the main thing is, the key is to see them as people, not just my child.
Not see them an extension of self.
Exactly, and not a possession as well.
Yeah.
And I think, like you said, it's being able to rationally manage that unconditional and all-consuming love.
Yeah.
A lot of our fear tends to stem from.
So you seem like just not an optimist about the world, but positive towards the idea of kids.
Yeah, because I feel like many times in history, people are considering giving birth to children in very precarious circumstances. But I guess from a biological perspective, like, nature and humanity always find a way.
Yeah.
People have kids during wars, and people have kids during famines and other natural disasters, and you know, we see
kid could be the one that solves climate change.
It could be. And I think the key is to make sure that I raise someone that is conscientious and empathetic to other human beings. And I think that's the key, is that, like, if everybody collaboratively understands that it takes a village to raise a child, and while I have responsibility for my own children, I also have a responsibility for the world I create for other children, then I guess that will help. But if nothing else, just a big old sorry. A big old sorry, and be like, don't blame me, my parents couldn't even get a house because my parents gave birth to me now. I didn't ask to be born either.
It's kind of the opposite of, you know, that cliche, like, I didn't ask to be brought into this world. Yeah. And you're like, yeah, but I really thought about it.
I know.
I wasn't sure.
Yeah, but I took a very long time before this happened. And a lot of things happened in that time.
Yeah.
There were a lot. Listen, kid, when I started planning this, the MCU was at its height. And, you know,
yeah, but things were looking good.
Things were looking pretty good. We had the European Union.
Yeah.
Like, fascism was very underground.
Yeah. These movies are never going to get bad.
Yeah, exactly. You know, if you were, from where we were, you know, and your mother made a very attractive proposition, may I say. Nah, kids don't want to hear that.
Maybe not.
I'll leave that part out. Yeah. But everything else, but I'll be like, we were really in love, and cinema was doing pretty well. And
life was getting a bit boring.
Yeah, it was. You know, we survived. You don't know this, kid. Like, there was a whole global pandemic. Who knew what was going to happen?
Yeah, there's no way they've even heard about it.
Yeah, exactly. So, I think the main thing is that I'm always open to suggestions. And yeah. I never kind of being like, well, I'm your dad, and it sticks that way. And I think that is the key. So, however optimistic or pessimistic I am about the world, I'm just optimistic that I will do my best.
Lovely.
I think that's all you can do, so... That was a great question, nice. Prue.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much. It has made me pensive and broody at the same time. So that's great. So I think...
Yeah, just the perfect energy for...
Exactly. Got me in the right mind frame.
Traveling around regional Western Australia.
Yeah. But I mean, with that close proximity to nature, it does make me think about life. So with that being said, I would like to also pose a question to you, Prue.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question is based on the fact that I said we're both doing our first tour of Western Australia.
Yeah.
We're, what, 4 gigs in? 3 gigs in?
Yeah, 4.
4 gigs in. I think it's gone pretty well.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're 4 gigs in.
Good. They've all been nice.
They've been nice.
Yep.
I'll be honest, I've been pleasantly surprised. But one thing I find, because I think this is my 5th visit to Australia. And from what I can see, there seems to be, with all the comics I meet, very healthy scene, very diverse scene. I think a scene with massive ongoing potential. But I have noticed a lot as well that a lot of the comedy offerings that you find in broadcast media tend to not be Australian. And I've also seen that, like, maybe some of Australia's more distinct stars that I've seen in more recent times have also left Australia in order to maximize their potential, like Ronnie Cheng, for example. Great guy and great comedian. So I guess it's definitely a great place to visit where comedy is concerned, and that could be part of the fact that, you know, I'm the privilege of being on a tour. Historically, I performed at places like the Comedy Store in Sydney.
Yeah, great venue.
Yeah, great venue. Number of different gigs in Melbourne as well.
Festivals?
I've played the festival. I've played the Greek, which is a great venue. I think I've played the Chinese Museum as well.
Yeah.
Also a great venue as well. As well as a lot of the galas. I've had the privilege of performing at the Sydney Opera House. But I'm aware of the fact that I just waltz in and get that kind of stuff. And
not the day-to-day grind.
They're not the day-to-day grind, exactly. So my question was, in your opinion, as someone who has received plaudits but is obviously still in the grind as well, like I am, in your opinion, what things do you think Australian comedy needs to prioritise in order to reach its potential?
Oh, I know exactly what they need to prioritise, and it's taking risks.
Nice.
Like, Australian comedy... And it's hard not to, you know, I'm still very much early on in my career as a comedian, and I've had a really great run, and a lot of it has been live work.
Yeah.
So doing gigs, doing these tours, and that's all great.
Yeah.
But I think in particular, the Australian media and TV, it is bringing new acts along.
Yeah.
But they're slow to do that and slow to tap into the scene.
Yeah.
And the number of spots that are available seems pretty limited.
Yeah.
And there's not opportunities. Like, I have the feeling I would love to stay in Australia and have a career in Australia as a comedian. But you do get the feeling like there will be a point when you hit the glass ceiling, and if you want more opportunities, you have to move to America or the UK.
Yeah.
And that's where you can maybe, like, I would love, you know, in terms of what I want for my career, as, and I guess everyone, it always shocks me when I talk to comedians that everyone has different wants.
Yes.
For the, you know, it seems like kind of one career, but there's so many different paths.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to do more writing and have TV shows and work on narrative and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just not many opportunities to do that here.
Yeah.
And I think that would be the sort of thing I'd have to move
follow. So in your opinion, like, so far as like, or as far as you're aware, I should say, what are the normal outlets for comics to transition from live work into television? Because, like, for me, like I said, I get to come to Australia and you're straight into a gala.
Yeah.
And then off the back of the gala and some networking, I got to do Tom Ballard's show, for example, who has a TV show.
Which didn't last very long.
And it looked, for me, it was a good format, and it seemed like it made sense, and I guess that's an example, I guess, of them risking something, but maybe not investing in it.
But yeah, it just doesn't really get time to become its own thing, and we don't have, you know, when you watch... All we watched, you know, all my parents watched is Would I Lie to You from the UK, but they would refuse to watch Would I Lie to You Australia.
Really?
And...
Have they tried it before?
No, they wouldn't even try.
That's so strange.
There's a lot of cultural cringe around Australia. A lot of tall poppy kind of syndrome. And, like, they, you know, that's tried and tested.
Yes.
And they have names they like.
Mm-hmm.
But because the Australian comedy scene hasn't offered those opportunities historically, or they've gone to a very small number of people, they watch those shows and they go, I don't know these people. I know the UK names more.
I see what you mean, yeah. It's a strange thing as well, because it's like, there's not as many people here for a start.
Yeah.
So to be able to learn about rosters and kind of pick who you'd like shouldn't be that difficult. And it's a strange thing for me to witness as well, because the impression I always get from the Australian comedy scene is that, you know, it's almost anathema to be like a cliche or hacky comic, from what I see. Like, for you to be a comic that, like I said, did the kind of cringe stuff, I've not seen any comics be well regarded or anything of that nature. Most comics here speak explicitly and candidly about like issues, whether it's race relations or inequality here, and yeah, like people kind of get into it and have a good disposition. So do you think that's a sentiment that's quite unique to the scene and not shared by Australia socially? Is that the problem? That because obviously people are laughing when they're watching this stuff, so it's not like what comics are discussing is an alien concept.
Yeah, I don't know. I find it so... it's a mystery to me as well. And it's hard because I have had a lot of support in my career and people have been really helpful and really trying to get you in front of people and get you up there. And it just doesn't take.
Yeah.
Or the show, they're nervous. They don't want to take a risk on someone new.
Yeah.
Like a lot of it feels... until you've proven yourself in some sense of having a profile, maybe you've gotten big online.
Yes.
They don't trust that you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have... like, something I always wondered is whether... because the shows kind of run season to season, they don't have those long-standing histories like UK panel shows.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody is secure in their position.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have... hosts that really want to support the younger talent, they're still nervous about their jobs
and their
career security and whether that is what it is.
I think probably part of it, because again it's like there is definitely some parallels there between British comedy and Australian comedy, and it's an interesting thing because obviously British talent seems to be tried and tested, and I've seen a number of British acts who have, I'd say they have a substantial career in the UK.
Yeah.
But I can come to Australia and still do enormous venues and pick up a very, and yeah, fast track having an audience because of the stuff that they've done that gets shown over here, and they can pick up quite easily. And it's a very strange thing because one of the things I definitely say to a lot of comics in the UK is that it will probably serve you more for a lot of people to tap into Australian audiences rather than American ones, because culturally there's so much more parallels between Australians and Britons.
Yeah.
That it wouldn't be that hard, but that might be the problem as well, is that some people do it a bit too much, which kind of means it's less work for Australian media, in that we could come up with domestic formats, but they're similar enough to us that we can kind of put them up there, which I think is, it's not particularly productive.
Yeah, it's a really strange landscape, and I don't want to, you know, there are a lot of comedians that kind of want to blame it on the industry and it's all of these problems, and maybe that's the case, but I don't know, I just believe that it will.
Is there like a long standing competence within industry? Because in, for example, I did a sitcom on BBC Three, which was like BBC's like online offering, and it had been like the first sitcom with a majority black cast on the BBC in like over 25 years.
Right.
And so it's a great milestone, but it meant that like in terms of creative control, I hadn't written anything for TV before, but there wasn't a lot of people I could be like, well, what do I do here? Or how's the best way to represent this? Because obviously, if there's not been people there who have made something of this nature for 25 years, the competence isn't really going to be there, in the same way that if you went to a garage with the car that, you know, was a Ford, and these guys have spent 25 years doing Vauxhalls, then they're probably going to struggle with being able to work on that particular model, is how I see it. But it's a really strange thing that, like, obviously, there's been people who've had a lot more experience in television in the UK. Is it because there's just not a lot of people that are savvy to comedy that work in television or working online? Is it they're not savvy to that? Or is it they're just learning it themselves as well? Or is it that they know what, or like you said, it's just that they could maybe invest, but it's like, I can do this, or I can just grab a panel show and put that on Australian TV and say
I think it's maybe that, and I feel like the sense I get is that there are so many people that want it to be more of a thing across the industry, across the media, and maybe there's just like an ingrained nervousness in the system that kind of waters it down along the way, but then, you know, I just don't want to sit here and say, oh, it's the industry's fault and they're not making space and they need to do XYZ.
I just wanted to let you know. That might be the case. And if this is the straw that breaks that back, then...
But I guess this, for me, I feel like what I should be doing is find a way to make what I want.
Yeah.
Even if it's a you know, 5-minute YouTube video. And I'm not hustling like that. So it's, you know, I'm part of the problem as well.
Yeah. But I mean, is it part of the problem? Because obviously I feel like that has been a question that a lot of comics are asking themselves, is it if it's just because I need to have an online presence in order for me to be successful. But even then, I think it's kind of questionable, because what you tend to find by then is that by the time larger distributors or networks get on board, you don't necessarily need them. Yeah. So for example, for me, when I came here, like maybe 2016, everyone had told me who Auntie Donna was before I'd even met them. And they already told me, like, they had uploaded content onto YouTube, they had stuff on like PlayStation Network. So even I was aware of them before they had a TV show or like a streaming show. So yeah, it's sometimes it's like, it seems, yeah, that people want you to be the finished article and have the following before they give you a platform. And I think it's a strange thing, because it might just be a large problem overall, where it's like people feel like there's not as much money to be made from development as there is just from distributing something that already exists. But I just think that what you tend to find is, and what I've noticed, not just in television or just in comedy, but in general, is where it seems to be artistically scraping the barrel everywhere.
Yeah.
Everything is like, we're just trying to recycle nostalgia, rehashing of pre-existing formats and intellectual properties, and like shows our parents watched, be like, guess what's coming back? And
I'm
like,
why?
Like, yeah, it's like, you know, rerun stuff, so they're bringing it back, remastering stuff that was never that great in the first place. And it's a strange thing, because like another thing I noticed is, so it's comic Nigel Ng, who did the character Uncle Roger.
Yeah.
And I remember saying to people as well that, like, once this guy is able to tap into the Asian diaspora, in terms of like Asian millennials, Generation YZ, who might be living somewhere like Australasia, it's a wrap, because people that are so seldom deprived of representation of themselves, they'll latch onto this. And yeah, he's having an amazing career as Uncle Roger because he's able to tap into it. And for me, it's just so strange, because I get such a vivid picture of Australia as it is narrated by comedians, that it's not a country with an industry that's perfectly poised to kind of elevate that.
Well, and I always wonder, you know, maybe part of it is that the comedian mindset has to change.
Yeah.
Because why are we so stressed about getting on these TV shows when I don't know anyone who watches TV?
Yeah, that's it. This is it.
That's not on streaming services.
Which is a good point. And yeah, I get that as well, because obviously, just in our natural line of work, we don't even get to watch TV that much.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess, and it's, yeah, you're right. Could it be folly that we're trying to position ourselves in a medium that is actually on its way out?
Yeah, chase after a model that might be broken.
Yeah, and it's not really doing much now. But I think overall, and I guess for me, the issue, I suppose, is the fact that even though it is a model that's on its way out, it still exists as a centralized institution of power.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, while we have a lot of autonomy on stage, we don't control how that gets out to a larger audience and how that is doctored. And
I would love the feeling of legitimacy.
Yeah.
That a TV appearance.
Yeah, exactly. And
it brings a comedian.
Yeah, because then it's like, I'm in front of everybody, and it's still a rite of passage. We've looked at our predecessors, and how we've become aware of them, and so we see it. Because for me, like, I was always a fan of comedy, but so far as like open mic and how circuits worked, I didn't know that until I started doing comedy.
Yeah, no idea it even existed.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess the question is like, how we can push that art form globally, because it frustrates me as well, because like, whether it's Australian TV or British TV, comedy is one of the most cost-effective formats that you can kind of do, because we got most of the ideas anyway.
Yeah.
A lot of time, we are able to make these ideas work on the stage with just a microphone. So everything else you add on top of that is basically a bonus.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of all the people, like... And it's a weird thing, because it's like, YouTubers have become massively successful and become the stars of today just by talking into a microphone and sometimes staring into space.
Yeah.
We can do that easily. We're so good at that. And often. And the difference is, well, you know, when YouTubers will speak about their mental health and like, you know, comments and being kind, try hearing it out loud, YouTubers. It's not nice when someone writes your shit. Imagine someone shouting it out to you.
Yeah, we're shouting.
Yeah.
It's It's all shouty stuff.
Yeah, we get shouty stuff. So comments are nothing but, like, you know, transcripts of heckles.
Yeah. Oh, man.
But we actually hear that live and direct. Is there anyone you've seen, though, like a success story of more recent times or any peers that you've seen that makes you think maybe things are changing or maybe every blue moon they can catch the right person?
Yeah, I think they definitely get the right people. And there's a lot of comedians that I love. You know, I love Anne Edmonds.
Mm-hmm.
And she does great things here. And I think she went to the UK briefly, but is still living in Australia and doing great things. And mm-hmm. Celia Piccola.
Yeah, and shout out Celia.
Shout out to Celia. And, you know, Greg Larson. And there are people that are kind of still...
Because I remember I met Steen Raskopoulos out here.
Okay, I've never met Steen.
So, and Steen has done quite a few things in the UK. Obviously, Celia did great things in the UK. And I remember being here, like, it's after Ronnie Cheng got, like, Best Newcomer.
Yeah.
And, like, seeing where his kind of career has gone since then has been encouraging.
Yeah, there's people that have done great things, and I guess they have left. But I feel like it's coming, and maybe I'm just too... early on in my career where I haven't bashed my head against the wall enough yet
mm-hmm.
that I still feel a sense of
but I think it's the same thing as having a kid. It's like this is your baby and it's something that you're nurturing and creating and honing, which is your comedy voice and your creativity. Yeah. And you also want to have a certain level of optimism is that when this baby of mine matures,
yeah,
that there'll be a world in which they can thrive.
At what point do I get to become an overnight success? You know, exactly. 10 years in, 15 years in,
exactly.
We don't know. But I do think, for me, it's early, and I'm not at that point of yearning to be bigger and bigger and bigger.
Mm-hmm.
I have always tried to maintain. I don't want quick up, quick down.
Yeah.
I want slow, steady, maintained.
Exactly.
As a career,
mm-hmm.
and I want to get better and better and better.
Yeah.
But I also have thought to myself, if all it ever is open mics and medium level stand ups, I want to do that. You know, medium level kind of stand up shows.
Mm-hmm.
I want to do that for as long as I enjoy it.
Yeah. And that's the thing as well. Like,
I don't want to get bitter and then stop enjoying comedy.
Yeah, exactly. And then one day you tweet something or you do a TikTok, and next thing I don't want to be in the UK and be like, why is Prue trending? Oh, Prue.
Well, Prue trends all the time, but it's because there's this horrible woman called Prue McSween.
Oh no!
and everyone's always like, "What have you done, Prue?"
Does she get to be on TV?
Yeah, I think she does. See, I don't know much about her. I just know that her views are horrific.
That's terrific. Well, there needs to be some kind of swap and. You know, get some of your more incendiary and controversial views.
Let's water down the name of Prue.
Exactly. Or at least bring balance to it.
Yeah, you know, bring some balance.
We need a good Prue and a really, really, really good Adolf.
Yeah.
The world definitely needs a good Adolf.
Yeah, I think they've given up on that name.
Yeah, if your parents call you Adolf, they are not optimistic at all about your life chances. Or if they are, they clearly are jealous of that fact and they are directly trying to sabotage you because they do not want it to work.
Or they're optimistic about the rise of the neo-Nazis.
Yeah. And, you know, that comes with another whole host of issues and questions.
Is upsetting.
Yeah, it's pretty upsetting. I also imagine, like, you won't get cuddled much in that house. No.
Yeah, I can't even imagine it.
No, I don't think they'd be great. No one's ever like.
Maybe that's the sitcom idea to pitch.
It could be. Maybe the way the world is going.
That's the one.
The way the world is going. Who knows what we'll find in one of these green rooms is crazy. Is how many like comedy channels are in? Is there any channels dedicated just to comedy in Australia?
I don't think so.
Because I've seen good stuff on like is it ABC and there's a lot of stuff. A lot of British stuff on there as well.
ABC. They do some comedy shows. They've done great comedy shows.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not dedicated to it. They're pretty few and far between.
Mm.
The other channels kind of do like reruns.
Oh, yeah.
Or a lot of panel shows. They're all very news-focused.
Quite topical. And
topical,
so it becomes quite dated.
Talking about the news of the day.
Yeah.
Like, have you been paying attention?
And cheap seats and stuff.
Yeah, cheap seats and things.
Okay, cool.
So that's kind of like the focus of our comedy.
So it just needs a bit more diversity. Anything I can do from my position in the UK, or we can do, because I think British comics do benefit from the Australian comedy scene, and it would be great if we could cross-pollinate or share resources.
So I mean, after this chat, it feels like I guess just stop coming.
Yeah, fair enough.
And,
fair enough.
We'll build ourselves up.
Listen, I got to go with the going's good, Prue. You'll learn one day.
The comedy festival we had where no one was allowed. yeah. I think everyone had a pretty good time.
Oh, then Prue, you can get another award for winning Exclusion Fest. It could definitely happen.
No, I think it's... Yeah, I guess...
I think it's the same all round. I think we all, especially now as bona fide artists, we all want a world where art and creativity thrives and grows organically. And
support the people that you like.
Exactly, yeah. And we can do the same as well.
Shout their names from the rooftops.
Exactly. And we also need, I think a big issue is that economic reform. Because I wholeheartedly believe when people have more money to spend and more disposable income, then they are much more likely to invest in arts and entertainment. And I think the fact that a lot of us have to, whether we choose to or not, rely on corporate entities in order to supplement our success and visibility is a big issue as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, movies and TV shows make a huge part of my personality.
Exactly.
And we need new ones.
New
and
ideas,
more,
yeah.
And
to deal with new personalities and to reconcile our personalities. And Prue needs to make something so I can show my future children.
Yeah.
And be like, yeah, this could be you. You know, if you ever listen to me sometimes.
Yeah. You could be on Australian television.
Exactly. Out of my fucking hair. No, just kidding. Just kidding, future kids. I love you if you listen to this. Prue Blake, thank you so much for taking the time on the tour to do my podcast. It's been amazing. What I would love for you to do is please tell our listeners and viewers where they can see more of your good work, whether they be in Australia or otherwise.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dane. If you want to see more, you can follow my Instagram. It's probably the best bet, at Prue Blake Comedy. And sign up for my newsletter, I Shave My Legs for This, which is on Substack, and I rate every day that I shave my legs to see if it was worth the effort. And the spoiler is that it has almost never worth the effort to do it. But it's a fun way to kind of talk about different things that are happening, different observations that I've made in my life.
Nice. And I'm not going to speculate, guys, but Prue's legs do not seem particularly hairy today. So
they're freshly shaved.
There you go, guys. So
worth it.
I hope it's been worth it. Thank you so much, Prue. It's been a real pleasure. Guys, please do check out all of Prue's content and check out her social profiles. And if you are listening from the UK, start supporting more Australian comedians and support comedy in general. Thank you very much, Prue.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste. For more from Dane, go to danebaptiste.co.uk or follow him on Twitter at DaneBapTweets or Instagram at DaneSnapTeast. The show is produced by me, Howard Cohen. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at TheHowardCohen. The show is mixed and mastered by Audio Culture. You can follow Audio Culture on Instagram at WeAreAudioCulture. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at DBQEPodcast.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.